You're listening to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast. Hey there, and welcome to episode 22, our roundtable edition of the podcast. Joining me are Chris, Robert, and Jordan.
How are you guys doing?
Hi, good.
It's been a while since we've done one.
Was it before last year, I think?
It was before Christmas. It's good to get back in the swing of things. We have been a little behind on podcast episodes, and I apologize. No, I have a good excuse. The hard drive that I had the entire podcast on was stolen out of my car last Saturday, and it had a bunch of interviews that I hadn't put out yet, and so we're a little behind and trying
now
to make
I feel
up
bad for
Oscar.
Saying slacker.
Yeah, but the benefit is, you know, Hemingway lost his manuscripts at one point, and first he wanted to kill himself, and then he realized it was a gift because he was only going to remember the best parts of the stories.
Well, there you go.
So you just have to redo all the interviews.
Are you saying I'm the Hemingway of podcasting?
if you go back and just answer or ask all the good questions.
The good questions.
I don't know if that's such a good example, though, because he did kill himself in the end.
Yeah. I forgot about that. Sorry,
but anyway,
tasteless joke.
So we lost. I had a big music licensing super special that I was putting together, and I lost some of that and a bunch of other interviews that we were going to group together, and what can you do? So if you see another CD Baby podcast pop up that has those interviews, imposter will know who stole the hard drive. So anyway, we're trying to make do, and we have some more episodes lined up that'll be rolling out soon. But Jordan has some music news for us, so let's jump into that.
We'll start off today's news segment with the latest buzz surrounding mechanical royalties. In short, record labels want to pay less, publishers want to be paid more, and digital music providers want to pay nothing at all. Record labels argue that mechanical royalties should be lowered. They feel that their business has been in decline while profits at music publishing houses have increased. The RIAA has now filed paperwork with the Copyright Royalty Board to lower mechanical royalty rates to 8% of total revenues rather than the current rate of 9 cents per song. Digital music providers of streamable music argue that streams should be treated like traditional radio performances and should not require a mechanical license, but a performance license only. The royalty rate process was launched last week by a panel of 3 copyright judges and is expected to take a few months before a final decision is made. Similarly, the Harry Fox Agency, who issues mechanical licenses on behalf of most U.S. publishers, recently upgraded its Songfile mechanical licensing service to accommodate requests for smaller uses. You can now license compositions for as few as 25 units, and this includes CDs and DPDs, which are digital downloads. This is a pretty big deal because the minimum used to be 150 downloads and 250 CDs. In other news, hip-hop producer Timbaland was recently named Verizon Wireless's first mobile producer in residence. Timbaland is scheduled to release one new track each month featuring a different guest artist exclusively to Verizon Wireless customers through the company's VCast Music mobile service. All songs will cost $1.99 each for the download and will include a copy of the track for PC use. VCast subscribers will also be able to access the track through Verizon's website. Some industry leaders have previously claimed that wireless distribution via cell phone companies will be the future of the music industry. Could this be the first step in that process?
Well, thanks, Jordan, for bringing us the news and a couple interesting items there. The first one being that obviously the record industry is in turmoil right now, and they're arguing over royalties and
boo-hoo. Yeah. I could use a little clarification there. I don't know if I was napping during the first news article, but I didn't quite go in.
They want to restructure the way that mechanical royalties are paid. So the record companies are saying they can't afford it. The publishers are saying they want more, and then the whole online streaming, what is that company's name?
Pandora?
Pandora, yes. People like Pandora are having to pay, and they're all trying to sort that out, and nobody wants to pay, but everybody wants money. So
right.
So that's the layman's term.
Okay.
I think the most dramatic is what the labels are trying to do, or the RIAA is trying to do on behalf of the labels, which is rather than, it's always been you just pay 9.1 cents every time the song is distributed, and they're trying to change it to, what is it, 8% of total revenues. So it's
not even does that work out to be much less than I don't.
It's yeah. It'll
but
be.
The other portion of that Harry Fox agency lowered the number of what is it, Jordan?
The minimum amount that you can obtain a license for has been lowered. It used to be pretty high. Digital downloads were 150, and so that's down to 25. And
so if you were going to get a license to sell downloads
For a cover song.
For cover songs. You could only license 150, not for a year?
Right, and you have to renew that 150 every year, even if you were selling 5 downloads a year.
So now it's 25. So it helps out with the indie artists especially that is just, you know, making albums at home and only going to do a limited release. You know, you don't have to spend as much money to do your song legally. Yeah, it is
That's good.
That's good
for indie artists.
There are still some fees associated with, you know, you got to pay Harry Fox like $13, I think, or something per song. So it tends to add up a little bit.
Yeah.
But the last item of the news, I've heard people online talking about how people are going to release albums only through mobile phones and stuff like that. And it's just like, I don't know. I'm still not into the whole mobile phone music idea.
Do you listen to music on your phone? I'm so behind the times. I would never want to do that.
Apparently my phone does, but I use my iPod. So
yeah, me too.
I listen to music on my phone. It's only got one song and only plays when my mom calls. But
a lot of phones now. My phone has an MP3 player. I don't use it, but I can plug in headphones and. Like an MP3 player.
If I had an iPhone, I'd probably listen to music.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. All the phones that I've had, I think mine. I have a Razer. I don't know if it has an MP3 player on it or not. If it does, I'm not going to use it. You know, unless it's something as good as like an iPod as far as the usability. So
I think that at least right now, where companies like this could really benefit is using the fact that people might want to have really cheaply some music that they can listen to on their phone that's not necessarily the same music that they have on their computer and their record collection or whatever, you know, it's like almost a promotional device. I mean, artists want to give away free songs all the time. Why not just give people 100 songs with their telephones they can listen to or whatever, you know, like.
I believe that Universal is working on doing something similar to that. They're doing
well. They should hire me.
I think it's with Nokia, and I'm not sure of the exact specifics, but I think they're in the process of putting together some sort of bundle with Nokia.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the perfect music platform. I mean, because, you know, obviously if you get a lot of phone calls, you're not going to be able to, it's going to interrupt your music.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's just all usability. The device is what. Why the iPod became such a hit, it was just simple. People had all these, you know, really extensive personal digital PDA things.
Yeah.
And it's like you had to go through all these menus, and it's just like people just want it simple. It's going to be a pain in the butt to use. I'm not going to use it. Yeah. So at least for MP3 players, I just want to pull it out and start playing. But I'm not really into cell phones either, so I don't know. So I get like 3 calls a month. So that's all
that matters. Yeah, and he just announced it over the radio.
Let's move on to talk about, we had a couple episodes where we had interviews since we did a roundtable. So let's talk about those a bit. Let's start with Tom Simonson, the
practice.
Let me look at my notes here.
Put my podcasting hat back on.
Yeah. We've had 2 episodes since our last roundtable, and we wanted to open up the conversation and discuss some of the general themes that were covered. I'm starting with my interview with Tom Simonson. Just in case you haven't heard that episode, it was episode 20. And Tom is a manager, and he's managed a number of artists over the years and has been David Wilcox's manager for 18 years. So Tom was a really cool guy and had some great things to say. And
a little
sneak peek, he's going to be back on the show soon to
analyze me.
Have a little sit down with our resident artist here, Chris, see if he can kick his butt and get him headed in the right direction.
He's going to make me a star overnight.
I think that's what he plans on doing.
Oh, good.
Is that when they swing the pocket watch in front of your face?
Mm-hmm.
But indie artists and a lot of do-it-yourselfers, a lot of times don't have much experience with managers or don't know when they should bring one into the mix, but I was just curious if you guys know anybody who currently has a manager and anyone.
I know a local band in Portland called The Dimes that has a manager. He's helped them get in touch with, like, you know, great publicists and booking agents and all that stuff. So it seems like he's helping them put the pieces in place.
Be curious to find out how they, in a city like Portland, it seems like it'd be hard to come across a wide range of managers. And, you know, I thought it was interesting when in Tom's interview, he was saying that he realized that he no longer needed to be in LA. And I was shocked to find out he was up here in Portland, you know, and he's been here a while. So that's good news now that people can just kind of commute by email and the internet, that, you know, people are able to have access around the country to different people like Tom. But I think that's one thing that a lot of artists are, when they think about the idea of seeking out a manager, they're unsure of when that point would be that they would find a manager. And I think, Chris, I think you're around that point where you've had a lot of great press, playing some really good shows here in town and starting to venture out further, and it's time for someone else to shoulder some of that load so you can keep writing music.
Yeah, or at least just give me some really focused advice on how to start translating that into...
Have you thought about looking into getting a manager at all, or...
No, we'll see how this counseling session goes.
Tom will be your new manager.
Yeah. Right.
If you didn't hear the episode, Tom does some kind of management by appointment, I think is what he called it, and that's where he'll help indie artists just maybe, you know, for an hour here or there, or, you know, maybe once a quarter, touch base and kind of get pointed in the right direction and hook up with
similar
people.
Similar to, like, our previous interview with Lisa Lapine.
Yeah. Yeah, and what they do is probably very similar. Different styles, though, drastically.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Well, that's what's kind of interesting, too. I think that it seems like there's these sort of monikers or names that people in the music business name themselves. But in the indie music world, like, you're going to wear a whole bunch of hats no matter who you are, you know, if you're the publicist or if you're the record label owner, or at some point you're going to be the publicist, some point you're going to be the manager, some point you're going to be the musician.
Well, I found it interesting in Tom saying about how, you know, back in the day when he started, the manager's position was more defined, and that was like, you're the agent, you're the go-between the artist and the label and any other professional person that, you know, you can go do the hard bargaining and get people mad at you so they still love the artist, and, you know, and also so you can focus on your music, and there's just not enough time to deal with all that stuff, and your abilities are music. There's our negotiation and getting in people's faces. But he was saying how a lot of that's changing, where he's finding that he's doing a lot more of those things, like a little bit more booking, a little bit more publicity, a little bit more just doing it all himself, just because he has access to it, you know. There's less gatekeepers. So I also, when I was thinking about the episode, was also thinking about, when is it not the right time to have a manager? And I've met bands that, you know, it's just like, they have a good photo, they've played a couple shows, and they've got a manager. And it's like, they really don't have anything going on, but they've got somebody getting in people's faces, acting like they're the stuff when they really have nothing to prove. And I would say that would save the manager from when you can really go in with some, they're going to take you to the next level, and they, you have a reason to have them there.
Well, it depends on if they just get paid in beer or...
Because we should ask the Dimes, because I think it's sort of a friend, but, you know, obviously he's doing a good job, but I don't know sort of what capacity he served as a manager for anyone else. Maybe they just pay him in beer.
Because technically you would want to be at a point where you're getting a lot of good shows, good press, selling some records, and you need someone's help to get you to the next level and to shoulder some of the responsibilities you've been doing already, but also they've got connections to hook you up with bigger resources that you won't have access to. And so that would be the point to get a manager and start seeking one out, and not when you're just starting out. And, you know,
I think one of the reasons that you might not want a manager is if you do have a lot of resources already at your disposal, people, fans or friends that are willing to do, you know, work for you. If you built a really strong network, you may not need to have one person lightening that burden, because you may have lots of people around you that lighten that burden.
Yeah. And a manager is going to take, you know, a cut of all your income. So, I mean, you're going to, and so you want to make it worth their while and your while. And if you're going to pay them, that you want to make sure it's something that you truly need them on board to help facilitate your music moving to the next level.
So. Definitely.
Any other comments, thoughts on that? I think the last thing I would say is that you just want to make sure that the manager is a good fit. You know, there's a lot of great managers out there that, depending on the kind of artist you are and the kind of experiences they have, what you do, it may not be a good match. So that's always something to consider. Not just, hey, this person said they'd be my manager. You know, you gotta check out their credentials and see what kind of artists they've worked with. And
How important do you think it is for a manager to be a fan of the music that they're supporting?
Honestly, I don't think it's that important.
Really?
Yeah.
As a band, though, I don't think I would want somebody working on my behalf if they don't really, if they can't stand behind what they're.
Maybe they just have to believe enough that they can sell it.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I mean, I've seen managers where the reason they were a good manager for a certain band had nothing to do with their ability to, or their nothing to do with their like or dislike of the music. It was all about, they had the connections and they knew how to play hardball for the band and make things happen.
I was one of those people. I mean, I know there's others that are different, but like when I was a waiter in a restaurant, I knew that no one should touch the cherry pie. And they told me that I had to sell the cherry pie. Like, I couldn't bring myself to do it because I knew how nasty it was.
I'm with you, yeah.
Well, hopefully it's not a matter of they think you're horrible. It may not be that they, you know, you're not their favorite artist, but they know how to sell you and get you hooked up. They know the kind of people to hook you up with that love what you do and can.
It's one of those, well, I don't really like cherries, but people who like cherries love this pie.
Right. That's the better way to look at
it. And hopefully as a manager, you're getting paid more than you were as a waiter, which might change your outlook on things. Right.
Ooh, that cherry pie is starting to look good.
Well, why don't we move on to the last episode where, Robert, you interviewed...
David Harrington.
Yes, from Kronos.
It was absolutely great to be able to talk to David. Just has an amazing musical history and has just worked with all these amazing artists. I wanted to bring in and interview an artist that sort of had a musical background that was really diverse. You know, like, I don't know that much about chamber music, and it was a learning experience for me. And I mean, one of the most amazing things about that group is just how they've reached so many different markets with their music through all these different collaborations and partnerships. And I wanted to find out what was the genesis of that, you know. I think that David really had some interesting stuff to say. But, you know, I also wondered, like, because it was, I feel like it was a somewhat inspirational interview, I'm curious what you guys took from it. Because I think it was different than something as cut and dry as interviewing a manager or a publicist, where there's sort of, you know, these obvious steps. He's definitely more of a visionary than a business person.
I listened to it just as a fan, because I remember when I was in college, I had a CD that it had Black Angels on it, which he talked about as his basically influential, mind-blowing music experience. And then I think it had, I forget what it's called. You might know, Jordan, the Threnody, is that the name of the piece? Do you not?
Oh, I'm not sure.
It was something for the victims of Hiroshima. Anyways, these two string quartet pieces that were just amazing, and that got me really interested in more modern, like, concert hall music.
Yeah.
Besides just Mozart and Beethoven and the same old stuff, or whatever pop music I was listening to, so.
Well, I thought the whole idea of just the collaborations in general was an interesting one, and I just thought about, you know, how maybe me and my own music could take that and run with it, and maybe not just looking inside of what I'm doing and, you know, just what I'm writing, but maybe expand beyond that and look to do projects with other people that, you know, maybe even just totally different musical tastes. I mean, he's playing strings and, you know, chamber music and playing Hendrix songs and things like that. So, yeah. I mean, it was just an interesting idea of how he even approaches, you know, how he makes music.
The distortion on that one recording was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was intentional distortion, right? But it was amazing.
Yeah, this interview was great. I loved it.
I'm just going to say that. This interview was great.
No, it was just so interesting because I'm a classical musician also, and it just, his stories and stuff and what he's doing is just so great. Like, just how he crosses so many different borders. And I really loved when he was talking about how there's no genres. You know, music is music and you hear it and everything is an influence. And I really liked that. And I think it's really cool that he is playing classical music, and, you know, he acknowledges the roots and, you know, he mentions Beethoven and all that stuff. Yeah. And then, but then he's also doing Jimi Hendrix stuff. And yeah. I mean, he did that as an encore after playing The Rite of Spring. And it's just so, just really interesting.
Well, I think it's really interesting too, you know, whereas the internet is, has opened things up so much and caused so much competition that we need to shoot for our niche markets. Whereas, you know, David has really, you know, almost without any other strategy than just his own passion, you know, sort of hit so many different markets and crossed so many different boundaries without ever really considering, you know, the difference between his music and other people's music, you know.
Yeah.
He's just, you know, dove headfirst into it.
Yeah, he has everything. I was looking on iTunes and, well, he has like regular classical recordings, and there's the Indian, I can't remember what her name was.
Asha Bhosle.
And then I noticed they have an album of Sigur Rós. I'm not sure how exactly to pronounce that, but Sigur Rós.
I don't think anyone knows how to pronounce
it. Yeah. But there's an album of him covering a
they've
few,
done, yeah,
a few
they've
songs.
Yeah, they've done Mexican music and worked with all sorts of different cultures. Dave Matthews. Yeah. One of the things that he talks about, I mean, it's so interesting because I came at the interview thinking that I would, that there would be more method and more technique behind it. And instead I just, you know, just this incredibly passionate man, you know, and that like his passion alone has lifted and created his career.
And the hours of practice that he didn't tell you about.
Right, right. Well, he didn't. But I think that, you know, I mean, I think that there's plenty of equally accomplished musicians out there playing in symphonies that haven't done anything like what he's done. You know, they haven't performed Howl at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that that sort of risk-taking and manifestations of his own passion for music outside the lines is something that has really propelled him forward.
Yeah. I loved, my favorite part of the interview was when he was talking about how he had to play that piece with no vibrato and how that changed his
whole. How they played.
Yeah, and it just reminded me of this story. I studied recently for a few months with Don Weiss, who was the principal flute player of the Oregon Symphony, or Portland Symphony for a long time. And she used to make me play these pieces, like French romantic pieces that are, you know, really have a lot of vibrato. That's what they're known for. And she would make me be really expressive without using vibrato.
Oh, wow.
And I wanted to kill her. I would get so frustrated. It's so hard. It was just really interesting to hear him talk about how that was the point of his life that
moment.
Changed
yeah.
everything. Because for me, that was when I started hating music. I was like, I don't want to play this game anymore.
I figured, having worked with so many different artists, that there would be all sorts of catfights and gossips and, you know, like everything that happens when people work together. I mean, God, you know, going on to tour for 2 weeks is about as much as I can handle. But he, you know, like he just seemed so nonchalant about how just wonderful these experiences and collaborations were, and how talking about dissolving the collective ego and just giving the piece, putting that at the center of what they were doing, rather than, you know, letting egos and artists get in the way of what they're trying to accomplish, which is ultimately just put something musical on stage for the audience and not put artists on the stage to be, you know, fawned over or whatever.
Well, I wanted to end with a little bit of listener feedback. We always say we like hearing from you guys, and especially find it interesting when we hear back from people that aren't in major cities, because Portland, it's not LA or New York, but it's still a big town with lots of things going on. And we got this email from John in Montana, and I'm going to read it here. What you guys do for artists is truly helpful, especially for those of us more removed from a larger, more dynamic scene. Our band is called Broadband Shortwave, and we're from Montana. And while it's not difficult to find an audience for many country or folk groups, it can be a challenge for an indie rock band to carve out a new niche among listeners here. We've already taken a few pointers from you guys after listening to episode 9, which is the one where we talked about alternative venues and the house concerts, I think. We booked a show at a trendy downtown clothing store in our hometown. The gig ended up being one of the best we've ever had, with over 300 people in attendance, all paying money to come see us. And then in parentheses, he put, seems strange. But I thought, I loved that email because, you know, that when you think of Montana, you just assume, oh, there's no indie rock bands there. It's all country Western artists. But there's indie rock bands, there's country Western bands everywhere, you know, and all sorts of probably hip hop bands in Montana trying to carve out an audience. And so it was just interesting to hear how he took an idea about booking someplace other than, you know, there's probably not many rock clubs up there. And so he went to the trendy clothes store. I'm picturing something like an Urban Outfitters, but I don't know if Urban Outfitters is in Montana. But, I booked a show and somehow it worked. And they got 300 people out to pay for a rock show at a clothing store. And so that was a good idea.
That's great. We love hearing your feedback.
Yeah, so if you got any, you have any other stories of success stories like that, we love hearing about it. We'll read it on the podcast.
Or unsuccessful stories.
Yeah,
as well.
Unsuccessful. the please don't do this. That's a good one to finish on. So if you have anything, you can email us at info@cdbabypodcast.com. I think that'll do it.
Peace.
We'll catch you guys next time.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.
Let me put my podcasting hat back on.
I push ahead, I try to grow, I keep learning things I already know. Stepping up is a place to go. When I step too fast, then I slip down slow. Gotta reach for the sky. It's a decision I'm reaching. The harder I try, deeper the meaning. The truth I would learn is that the trick is believing. But the question, deceiving. I don't break my back and work instead. I just waste my life and I wreck my head. It'll be all right. Friend of mine won't stand. Get it all done now. Sleep when you're dead. Gotta reach for the sky.
See you.